Most important thing is not about your knowledge. Most important thing is not about how much you can achieve or how much you can earn. But the most important thing is what gives you pleasure. You don't have to be dependent on the systems. You don't have to be dependent on the circumstances around you. You can be the one who can create your own path. And that path doesn't have to be a CEO, CFO, or president of any health system. It can be anything. You can be a person who will be happy as a physician.
Welcome to PEMA On Demand, the podcast where we explore leadership, innovation, and the real-world journeys of physicians shaping the future of healthcare. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Mihir Patel for Hospital at Home, Promise, Perils, and the Fine Print. Mihir is a physician executive whose career spans hospitalist medicine, innovation in digital health, AI, and hospital at home. Dr. Patel has authored numerous articles in a variety of publications, including The Hospitalist, a publication of the Society for Hospital Medicine, where he also serves as an editor. He is a graduate of the Physician Executive MBA program at the University of Tennessee's Haslam College of Business. Welcome to PEMBA On Demand, Physician Leaders Making a Difference. I'm Norm Chapin, your host. PEMBA On Demand is produced for physicians seeking professional development. We discuss a wide range of topics on the podcast, including successful innovations in a variety of healthcare disciplines, current issues in healthcare career development, and healthcare leadership. I will be interviewing physician leaders from the U.S. and from other countries, most of whom graduated from the Physician Executive MBA program at the University of Tennessee. The information provided in this podcast is for general informational purposes only and does not constitute professional advice. The views and opinions expressed by the host and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the University of Tennessee or any other organization. By listening to this podcast, you acknowledge and agree to these terms. Whether you're sipping your morning coffee, commuting to the hospital, or just looking for a dose of inspiration, we've got you covered. We hope you will take full advantage of these practical, insightful, and relevant discussions designed to help physician leaders get new and build upon existing leadership skills and perspectives. PEMBA On Demand will allow you to be an even bigger force for good in healthcare. Well, Mihir, welcome to PEMBA On Demand.
My pleasure.
I'm excited to talk to you today about hospital at home and the hospital at home movement. I wonder if maybe we could start by just having you explain, kind of in plain English, what is hospital at home and what problems has it been built to solve?
Sure. So basically, hospital at home is not new, but it is more into the focus after COVID-19 when there was a capacity constraint. So basically, hospital at home is not just a remote patient monitoring or monitoring of the chronic disease, but it is basically the substitution of the brick and mortar acute hospital stay with inpatient level of care delivered in patients' home. So I would say it was built to solve mainly the three things, which is massive convergence of the systemic failures. First one is the capacity crisis. So we simply do not have enough physical beds or nurses for the aging demographics. And hospital home as a pressure release valve for the emergency department boarding. The second thing is the toxicity of the hospital, which means the harm which hospital creates towards the patient. So our older patients or older adults, hospitals are inherently dangerous environments, and it disturbs the sleep, strip away mobility, and expose patients to hospital-acquired infections and hospital-induced delirium. So a hospital home kind of also helps to mitigate or resolve that part. And the last thing is, of course, the finance, the cost curve. And the overhead of the physical hospital bed is financially unsustainable. And this model strips away the real estate and the hospital cost of care and focusing resources purely on the clinical intervention. So I would say the three things, capacity, harm, and the cost, is what the hospital home trying to solve.
There's a lot of interesting topics there that we could unpack. One of the first things that just popped into my head is you've spent most of your career working as a hospitalist. How does a a hospitalist become interested in trying to explore alternatives to putting patients in the hospital where they work?
Yeah. So the hospitalist work is basically, it's like a work, you work in a factory. You see the patients, you write the HNPs, you write the progress note, you just share the patients. Same routine. This new innovation model, which focuses more on the same thing, but the patient is at a different location. And it also comes with a lot of technology, a lot of new redesign of the workflows, innovation, and everything else. So as a hospitalist, it really helps me to kind of get away from my monotonous workflow into something new. And I would say, as a hospitalist working in the hospital as well as working with the hospital at home model, it's more of the hybrid work for me. And that really gives me a pleasure. It really helps me to reduce my burnout as a physician, because I can see the patient in the hospital. I can see the same patient or maybe a different patient at the home. But I can also look into their house. What is the situation at home? What we are talking about, social determinants of health. This is where it comes into the play, that how is the patient's home environment? How is the fall risk, et cetera, et cetera? How is the caregiver support? So this is really a very unique situation where doctor don't just see the patient in the hospital and take care of them, but also see their home environment at the same time and also address the medical issues.
So how do most people access a hospital at home? Do they start with a sort of a traditional, what we would think of as an inpatient hospitalization, or are these patients that can be admitted to a hospital at home program from an emergency department?
So it can be both. Actually, I would say it will be multiple ways patient can be hospitalized into this program, which is the most typical is the ED. The long ED boarding part is the problem, and this hospital home solves that problem, the first hand. The second thing is the inpatient, patients who are already in the hospital but need the longer treatment, and they are stable enough to go to home with for these IV treatments. We can take them into hospital home program. But also some of the patients directly get admitted from the clinics. If the patient is evaluated by the physician on the same day in the clinics in the outpatient setting, and let's say a patient is not responding well to some of the oral treatment and need IV treatment under the care or supervision of the physician, this can be the answer as well. But answering your question, the ED part is the main gate for the hospital home, where the physicians first hand see the patient, triage them appropriately, and then based on certain clinical criteria as well as the very superficial social criteria, kind of send the patient towards us, and then we can do more screening, triaging, et cetera, et cetera.
What is your team like? What does the team look like? How many people are on your team, and where do they have initial contact with these patients?
Sure. So let me answer one more question before I answer this. Sure. The candidacy of those patients. And the candidacy of those patients would be some of the common diagnoses what we treat in this program. It is like cellulitis, UTI, COPD, pneumonia, congestive heart failure, let's say diverticulitis, sometimes just rehydrating patients for a few days in like a diarrhea or dehydration or renal failure conditions. So those are the conditions. And when we are talking about this condition, that helps you to understand our staffing model, because we are not really treating sick patients. We are treating patients who are already in improvement course and who do not need that many touch bases every day, like they are in the ICU or step down unit, or since they are on the med surg floor. So answering now your question about the team. So it depends how big is the program. I work for different programs, and I have seen the team of 70 physicians in the hospital home program with multiple support teams, which includes case managers, social workers. The logistic part is very massive, and it happens on the back end, but there is a team for the couriers, deliveries, pharmacists, et cetera, et cetera. In the smaller program, I have also seen only 5 physicians working, with some paramedics with APPs, advanced providers as well as some nurses. So it depends what kind of health system is running the show and whether it is urban versus rural.
And are most of these programs run by health systems?
Yes. Health system, basically, the most of this program is run because of the health system has the waiver for the hospital at home program. And the waiver is located to the hospital or it is attached to the hospital. So yes, the system owns the program, but they always use the third-party services for logistics, for home RN or paramedics, etc. Sometimes they also use the third-party services for physicians, as for the hospitalists, telehospitalists. So there is a various models here, but larger health systems, integrated health systems like Kaiser or Intermountain Healthcare, they have their own everything. So physicians, hospitals, RNs, home health, logistics, etc.
Great. So what does the evidence show so far about the outcomes in hospital at home programs?
So the data is coming out of the mature program is overwhelmingly positive. And so outcomes and safety is concerned, the mortality is equivalent or strictly better than the physical hospitals. And we see near zero rates of hospital-acquired infection and massive reduction in falls and delirium.
Really?
Because patient is at home, and before we send them home, we make sure patient has the right social environment, right support at home. And based on that, patient qualifies for this program. So yeah, in home environment, they know which sofa is where and which chair is where. Even though they are weak in the hospital environment, that's a new environment for them. So, of course, we see a lot of fall versus in hospital versus at home. It is almost near zero. It happens. I'm not saying it doesn't happen. It happens. But most of the time, one of the criteria for hospital home candidacy is that patients should have a safe home environment as well as the caregiver support if patient is weak. And if those two checkboxes are checked, then the fall rate really goes zero. As far as the delirium is concerned, yes. Usually patients who are confused, we do not take them to the hospital home. And once patient at home, usually they do not get confused if their disease condition or medical condition is improving. Especially in the home environment, the confusion risk is really very low compared to the hospital because of so many different things happening at the hospital, while versus home, this is their own familiar environment. So that's outcome and safety. As far as the patient experience is concerned, the NPS, Net Promoter Score, often sits in the 80s and 90s, which is at the roof. So patients are sleeping in their own beds, eating their own food, recovering with their family. So yeah, of course, patient experience is definitely going to go up. And as far as the cost is concerned, startup cost is high because that's a fixed cost. But once you expand, once that fixed cost of setting up the hub and technology is taken care of, the actual cost per acute episode averages 15 to 30% lower than a brick and mortar stay. So it's a definitely win-win, but initial cost is always high and you need to have at least 20 to 30 patients in the program to break even. And after that, as you expand, everything is positive.
One of the other arms that you talked about, or one of the other reasons that systems start these up, is because of capacity issues. What kind of impact did the study show that this has had on capacity and ED boarding?
So, you know, in most of the urban health system where there is a high patient density, it is not easy for those emergency room to expand the beds or increase their capacity. Mm-hmm. And therefore, you see whether it's a Kaiser, it's a Mayo Clinic, or it's a Mount Sinai or John Hopkins, their ED capacity is limited, but the number of patients they are treating, instead of going it down, it's still keep going up and up. So because of the limited capacity, ED boarding happens. It happens and it gets even longer. The research stays, patient stays in the ED longer, there is a more harm from hospital-acquired infection, delirium, just what we just talked about. So this model definitely decreases that problem or try to address this problem, because instead of patient waiting in the ED to get admitted on the floor upstairs, that's what we say, patient is directly taken from the ED into the program, transferred to their home. And when that happens, of course, all these ED boarding start going down. And of course, that also helps with the patient experience and the healthcare risk. So ED capacity is definitely the first thing what this program address. It's like a pressure valve for the ED. So all these extra pressure which is building up in the ED is trying to get released using this program.
One of the other areas that I know I always struggled with when I was working in the emergency department and managing hospitals as a chief medical officer was this issue with hospital readmissions. What impact do you see hospital at home having on the readmission problem?
Yeah. So again, as the quality goes up, the patient safety goes up, readmission definitely goes down. And the study says that readmission is definitely 20% less than the typical brick and mortar hospital stay. And the reason is same, because when you are looking at the patient every day in their own home environment, you are seeing them taking their own pills in front of the camera when they are in this program. You know exactly what they are taking, what time they are taking, and how much they are taking. That means that you are doing real-time medication reconciliation, real-time medical education, medication education, as well as they also have a home support. And if they don't have a home support, we provide them a home support as needed. But that helps to reduce the readmission. Second thing is, of course, readmission secondary to all these hospital-acquired condition, and that doesn't happen. So patient initially stays in the hospital for a day or two and then get transported back to home and finish rest of the treatment at home. So their hospital stay minimizes, most of the stay becomes at home, even under the inpatient care. But all the harms comes with the inpatient care, of course, gets substantially lower compared to real brick and mortar inpatient care. And that decreases the readmission back into the hospital. We are talking a lot about the social determinants of health in this model, because the nurse who goes and check on the patient at home can also look into patient's fridge and see what my CHF patient is really eating. How much salt this patient is eating? How is the patient's home layout? Is there a risk for fall? Yes, if there is a risk for fall due to home layout, cluttered environment, nurse helps to resolve that problem by involving some other resources as well. So it is a multifaceted addressing of the issue by not physician, nurses, or any single person, but also patient's family gets involved actively into this. So it's basically multiple people, including patient and the family. They themselves are trying to get the patient better. And definitely all these efforts translate into decreased readmission.
It sounds like an amazing program. And it sounds like it's producing some amazing outcomes as well.
Yes, it is, definitely. And it depends. It is still the new program for most of the health systems. And some of them have got mature, because some of them are running for the last 10 years, even before COVID-19. And some of them are just starting because of the waiver. And everybody's learning right now. But so far, I have not seen any literature which says that this is a program which definitely increased the cost or increased the harm to the patient, et cetera, et cetera. It is dependent on technology part. It is dependent on some of the new healthcare economics development part. But everybody's learning and everybody's getting positive out of it and applying to improve the whole process. So yeah, I'm really excited about it, how it will be in the next 5 years.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the future for hospital at home. And maybe you could kind of help me break down the finances. How does a hospital at home program really work from a payer perspective and from the patient's individual cost? Help me understand that a little bit better.
Sure. So for hospital at home program, you have to look through the lens of fixed versus variable cost. And I'm talking about from the payer perspective or the hospital perspective. So fixed costs, so you are building like 24/7 command center, licensing enterprise RPM software, and locking in expensive services level of agreement with logistics, pharmacy vendor, et cetera, et cetera. So that's a burn rate, which is high initially. But when it comes to the variable cost, your variable costs are incredibly low compared to the physical hospital. Because you don't have any real estate, you don't have any cafeteria staff, no physical bed maintenance or environmental services, etc. So that's where the benefit comes. And the other thing I would like to say is everybody was talking about the waiver, the parity, which means that whatever you get paid in the hospital, same amount of money you get paid for the same DRG in this program, and that's what the waiver is about. But even with certain integrated health system without waiver, they are running this program for many years. And the reason why? Because these integrated larger health systems, they don't have to worry about DRG or pay-per-services or pay-per-episode, because they are the insurers, they are the hospitals, they are the one who owns the physician groups, and they also own the supply chain. So they basically have these members or patients on which they get paid certain amounts, some certain dollars per month or certain dollars per year. And whichever way they treat them, whether in the hospital or at home, but if they can keep these patients healthy, that's where the margin comes. So with even without the waiver in these situations, if patient gets better, let's say pneumonia staying 5 days in a hospital versus 2 days in a hospital and 3 days at home, that 3 days of margin, whatever money you save being a health system, that's your profit, regardless whether you have a waiver or not. So that's, I'm talking about the larger health, integrated health system, which is, of course, again, Kaiser and Geisinger or Intermountain Health. When it comes to the smaller system or semi-integrated health system, that's where the waiver comes. Waiver is helping them to have a pneumonia treated at home versus pneumonia treated in the hospital, but it is the same DRG and same amount of payment per episode. Now the hospital or health system has to find out how to create the right workflows in the hospital at home program, mm-hmm. and to save that margin to treat the same amount of DRG, same amount of pneumonia, CHF, UTI, and that's where the saving comes from.
Thank you for explaining that. I appreciate it.
Sure.
What is the average length of stay in the program?
Again, it depends what diagnosis you are treating, but as I mentioned previously, the common diagnosis is UTI, CHF, COPD, asthma, exacerbation, pneumonia. The average length of stay is also sometimes becomes actually higher than the in-hospital stay, because patients sometimes start liking the program and they want the doctor to come and see them virtually every day. They like that nursing visits and everything. But even the length of stay goes up at home, the cost of care does not go up. So it varies by the different programs. There is no right answer for that. The program which I have worked for, the length of stay is almost same as an in-hospital stay and sometimes higher, but the cost of care is low.
Okay, thank you. So I know that hospital at home, I think, has now been authorized out to 2030. Is that correct?
Yes. So the waiver is extended to the 2030. That's very correct. And that changes this whole landscape where all the health system and hospital CFOs, they were worried about putting a lot of dollars or fixed cost investment into these hub and spoke models, their command center. And they were just doing a little bit every year because the waiver was getting extended few months and few years. But now it is up to 2030, 5 years. So now everybody can plan accordingly, put more capital dollar investment into their infrastructure for the hospital at home. And that makes a lot of changes as hospital at home, because now it does not remain as an experimental program or something related to innovation. It becomes a part of the established or settled program for the health system. And that really helps to kind of mature a lot of processes and mature a lot of models around the payments, services, physicians, and nurses recruitment, etc.
What do you think the long-term picture is? I mean, if the waiver doesn't get extended past 2030, I guess first, what happens to the program? Is the investment that they were that systems made in all of the infrastructure going to be in place enough to support these programs if CMS pulls back the waiver? Or if the waiver goes away, is hospital at home going to contract severely?
So if the payment parity disappears, which means waiver disappears, the unit economics in a strict fee-for-service model collapses.
Okay.
If we are talking about something which happens in a year or two, which is not supposed to happen because now waiver is there at least for 5 years. But the cost of running the logistic network cannot be sustained on standard home health reimbursement rates. So waiver is about all this reimbursement. However, as I mentioned before, value-based care or capitated risk model, the economics are incredibly compelling regardless of waiver. And if a health system is on the hook for the total cost of care, utilizing hospital at home to prevent costly physical admission, drastically reduce 30-day readmission, and avoid skilled nursing facility or post-acute care placements, that generates the massive downstream savings. So it depends what kind of health system we are talking about. But again, I think right now waiver is not going away. And whether you are dependent on waiver or not dependent on waiver, everybody is getting benefit out of it.
So one of the other plans that Medicare has is that they want everybody off fee-for-service Medicare by 2030 as well. So is that...
Yes.
So that... from what you're saying, because most of those beneficiaries will move into a value-based care model, that could give strong support for continuing the hospitalist at home or the hospital at home program, even if CMS doesn't continue the waiver in the same structure that it is now.
That's 100% right. And that's the best healthcare environment, economic environment, innovative environment I would like to see, because then all the health system will have to figure out their own thing, because they know they want to save or they want to keep their value-based care money. But they are not everybody same. Some of the urban health systems, some of them are semi-urban, some of them are very rural. And they have to figure out innovative way that how they can keep these patients, whether in the hospital or at the home, but at the same time, what innovative workflows or procedures they can develop, or staffing or logistic they can develop, which can help to reduce the cost of care for these models without even waiver. And that's where the difference between urban and rural healthcare comes.
Okay, thank you. One of the questions that I wanted to ask you that I kind of skipped over, it sounds like there's a lot of virtual surveillance, a lot of virtual telemedicine type tools. Maybe talk to me a little bit more about how those tools are used and whether artificial intelligence, whether it's large language models or agentic AI, is becoming more and more commonplace in hospital at home programs.
Sure. So, and the technology is a big part of the hospital at home program. Hospital at home program has been running for a while, for many years, as I mentioned earlier, but the technology was not that mature that time. Now the technology is very mature, and that is after the COVID-19. So as far as the technology is concerned, I would like to put the technology in the software part as well as hardware part. And as far as the hardware is concerned, it is, of course, the patient-facing technology, which most of the hospital home program provide the tablet to the patient, through which patient communicates with the virtual nurses and virtual physicians. At the same time, patients also have the wireless devices attached to them, sometimes all 24 hours and sometimes as needed, which is basically your biosensors. At least you have your blood pressure monitor or blood glucose check monitor, which is wirelessly attached to those tablets through Bluetooth, and then it transmits the data automatically. So basically, it is kind of your remote patient monitoring kit. And with the technology, the cost of the kits are also getting more affordable for the healthcare system. And at the same time, they are getting more smart. The hardware part is getting more smart and more patient-facing, where patient can talk with these tablets or operate these tablets without too much of the technical difficulty. So that's the hardware part. The software part is, of course, the AI is the answer here. And AI can be integrated into this entire workflow multiple ways: patient-facing, physician-facing, logistic-facing AIs. And as far as the patient-facing AI is concerned, all the data which is kind of getting collected by the sensors at home, the AI part looks into it. And now AI is getting so advanced that any decrease or any changes of the patient's vitals, including heart rate, respiratory rate, can trigger some sort of notification to the monitoring people, whether it's the nurses or clinicians, which can give them advance notification before patient actually deteriorates. So let's say respiratory rate is going high or heart rate is going high before few days or few hours before patient deteriorates, and the AI can flag it appropriately that this patient may be in a high risk of deterioration. So then you can divert more resources, clinical as well as other resources, towards that patient. So that's the one AI example. Second AI example is the physician workflow or physician's time, which is being saved by the AI, ambient dictation, what we are talking about in right and left every day. And so many different dictation softwares available right now, which is integrated directly into your EMR. So physicians don't have to keep looking into their computers while talking with the patient on the video. The AI ambient dictation is already capturing everything important, and then it is transmitting into their structured notes after the visit is done. So it saves the time on the physician. And the third thing is the logistic part. And that's a very big part. That's mostly the hidden part, what we don't see as a physician. But the logistic is very important in the hospital home model, where the right resources needs to be delivered in the right time at the right location. And when you have, let's say, census of 60, 70 patients in this program in certain geographical area, and when you are rounding on these patients where you have to send the nurses twice a day to some of the patients, how do you logistically make it possible? So AI is really helping these challenges to get solved using the AI, the hub, or the command center people can decide which nurse needs to be where at what time. And if this nurse or this equipment is not getting delivered on time, who else can do that at the same time? So it is really like like Amazon delivery kind of thing. So, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure it's pretty complicated. This podcast is sponsored by the Physician Executive MBA program at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville's Haslam College of Business. In less than one calendar year, this program will equip you with valuable business acumen and leadership development not found in traditional medical school curriculum. Are you ready to join the longest-running physician-only MBA program in the country and a network of nearly 1,000 PEMBA graduates? Visit tiny.utk.edu/podcast for information about this exciting opportunity. And now we'll return to the episode. I've been hearing for years now about some areas in the world, and I think now some areas in the U.S. that are using drones and self-driving cars to deliver certain things. Is that something that you see in the future for these types of programs, as taking advantage of that technology?
Of course, it's not too far. As you have seen in Africa, they are delivering, some of the rural communities are getting the blood, actually, for blood transfusion. The drones are delivering this. And Amazon is already kind of doing a lot of experiments of delivering products for the same day or within a few hours to people's home or their backyards or on their terrace. So I would say, why not? It is just a matter of delivery. It doesn't matter who delivers it. Right now in the hospital home program, the delivery cost is very high because it's basically the medical couriers who deliver the things from the pharmacy to the home. When you forget to deliver, or when you forget to order one medication in that bundle, and just to, or let's say patient doesn't have a Tylenol at home or ran out of Tylenol, and you did not order as a physician when you order rest of the medication, and now you remember to order it. It costs $200 to $300 to just deliver Tylenol. The Tylenol itself costs only $5, but the delivery cost is very high. So yes, with answering your question, all this innovative way of delivery is going to come and has to come to decrease the cost of care here.
One of the social determinants of health that I think is most challenging in the United States today is just transportation. And I'm always amazed when we do the timely follow-up visits. I work in an ambulatory environment exclusively right now. But when we do the timely follow-up visits after a discharge from the hospital, it's amazing how many patients have not been able to access the medications that they were discharged from at home because they just didn't have either the money or the transportation to pick up the medications.
Yes. And that's where this program also becomes very handy, because you are still keeping the patient in the program, but you are also delivering all these medications to their doorsteps, into their refrigerator, and you are not relying upon the patient or patient's family to pick up or pay for it. So that's where the part of your readmission risk goes down. And you also, after you, when you are about to discharge this patient from the hospital at home program, you also make sure you deliver the medication for rest of the 30 days, 90 days at the home. So this is where all these medication safety and medication non-affordable concern gets resolved with the hospital at home program.
I see that as a huge advantage. Well, I have a couple more questions for you. One of the questions I wondered about when I started learning about this program, and you and I actually started talking about this program, was, are there any differences in terms of medical malpractice liability with these programs for either the physician or the healthcare system that's running it?
So I don't think there is a much difference than what we see in the hospital as far as the liability is concerned. The liability for physician and nurses or any clinical staff is the same as liability when you work in the hospital. And it lies in your health system or the hospital you're attached with or the hospital program with which this hospital home program is attached with. So it is a standard liability contract, what you have seen before in the hospital work. But the difference here is the tech and the logistic liability. And that's where it becomes more interesting. The reason they're saying that is because, let's say if patient deteriorates and you have to transfer patient back to the hospital, paramedics who is responsible for this as a part of this program has to be there within 15 minutes or 10 minutes or 20 minutes, whatever is previously decided structure is. If they are not there in that amount and patient has a problem due to that, that's where the liability comes. So it is mainly the operational liability. If the patient crashes and the contracted community paramedics takes 45 minutes to arrive instead of mandated 15, or if the RPM tablet loses cellular connection and fails to transmit the lethal arrhythmia, who is liable? This is where all these technology transport and staffing vendor ironclad contractual agreement comes in. Yes.
What about liability from the perspective of having healthcare workers go into a home when you may not know whether the physical safety in the home, whether it's because of a violent relative or weapon issues or those kinds of things? Have there been issues in hospital at home programs where that has caused liability issues for the health system?
So it would be the same as any home health company liability, because home health nurses goes to patient's home and they faces the same challenges. So it is the same thing what we can think about hospital home. That's where the social screening part comes, because when we are admitting patients from the emergency room or inpatient care into this program, there are two kinds of screening. We do clinical and social screening. And when we do the social screening, this is where all the questions get answered, that does patient have any psychiatric condition? The patient has any abuse or drug abuse? The patient has running electricity? Any problem with the food? And these are, and that's where all some of the red flags raises. If patient does not meet certain criteria, we don't even take this patient into the program. So I would say it is safer than home health, because at home health, you will have any patients regardless of the social conditions. In hospital home, you have to pass social screen, and this is safer than home health. But again, nothing is 100% safe and things happen. In my experience working with these programs in the last few years, we had only one incident. But again, when it comes to the liability, I think those nurses or those paramedics who are going to patients' houses, they are trained in a way that they are expected to face this sort of challenges sometimes. And how to handle them is a part of the training as well.
Thank you. So I want to ask one last question about hospital at home, and then I kind of want to pivot and talk a little bit about your decision to pursue some additional education beyond your MD. So what would it take to make a hospital at home program work in rural America versus urban or larger population density areas?
Yeah, and that's where this is completely different healthcare finances and logistic comes into the play. So scaling in this rural areas breaks the standard hospital at home logistics. you are fighting broadband dead zones and the unit economics of driving nurses 45 miles for a single 20-minute IV push. So to make it work in the rural area, you may need a little bit different technology, maybe asynchronous store and forward RPM devices, which don't rely on continuous cellular streaming, satellite internet provisions. So Starlink is now rolling out the small devices and small antennas everywhere. So that is one of the answer. But most importantly, you cannot rely on centralized hospital dispatch system. You have to partner deeply with the like a local rural EMS and fire departments to act as the hands-on care team, effectively turning community paramedics into the extension of the hospitalist. So this is the difference as far as the resources is concerned. And when the population density is low, sometimes these programs are not as beneficial as they will be in the urban or semi-urban area, because one physician will be able to maybe see only 3 or 4 patients a day because of the distance between those patients' homes. One nurse will be able to see only 4 or 5 patients a day because they have to drive too much to see these patients. So that's where the difference comes. In the rural hospitals, where we are talking about the rural hospitals are dying and they are trying to keep the local patients in their local environment. So I think in rural hospitals, maybe it is not as effective as it will be in the urban hospitals, where adding a one hospital bed costs $4 million. While in the rural hospitals, those beds are already empty in the hospital, and keeping patient in the hospital, which is the hospital itself like is like within 30 minutes from their home in rural area, it is beneficial to for the hospital as well as for patient to be in the hospital. While in the urban area, it is other way around.
Thank you.
Yeah.
One last question about hospital at home. How are you splitting your time right now between a traditional hospitalist role and hospital at home hospitalist?
That's a good question. And even I have to calculate sometimes, but I'm doing almost 30% in-house, which is hospitalist in the hospital. And 50% of my time is with this model, virtual model. And then rest of the 20% of time is kind of towards the innovation and some administrative time I have. So it differs based on the season. If there's a flu season and my presence is more needed in the hospital, I sometimes work 60, 70, 80% in the hospital and less in the in this model. So it depends.
So let's talk a little bit about what made you decide to pursue an MBA at the University of Tennessee. That's kind of how I connected with you. What role were you in when you made that decision, and why did you think that would be valuable for you?
Yeah, so I was already working 9 years before I pursued my MBA, 9 years as a hospitalist. I already had finished my master's in public health before I joined my residency. And then I finished my residency in internal medicine. And then I worked in rural community for almost 6 years, and then 3 years in the urban community. And then I decided to pursue my PEMBA MBA. But in a certain clinical point in my practice, I realized that being a good hospitalist allows me to impact one patient at a time, but to fix the system or systematic operational friction you face every day, the capacity issue, the broken workflows, you have to change the system itself. And when you step into the leadership role focused on clinical informatics and kind of virtual medicine, clinical intuition is no longer enough. You have to acquire the vocabulary of business. You need to understand the finances, unit economics, supply chain logistics, and change management. And that's where my decision to join PEMBA comes. And I'm really grateful for that decision, which I made, because it was not about just having the MBA title behind my name. But it is mainly about so much new knowledge, so many good friends I got during this, my journey of 12 months. And of course, we are still in the contact. And this knowledge is not 1 year of knowledge. It is kind of, it increased my appetite to have more knowledge of different topics, what we have already learned in the PEMBA, one of them, which I'm very interested in, lean workflows. So this hospital home program is based on the lean workflow, right thing at the right place without any waste. And that's what I'm trying to apply in these models as well. So, yeah.
So it sounds like it really helped you think about things from a system standpoint and process improvement standpoint, rather than just the one-on-one changes you can make as you're dealing with an individual patient?
Definitely, yeah. When I'm sitting across the table from the CFO and trying to prove the ROI for any ambient AI or model the break-even census for a new hospital home hub, I think I need to talk that language, and that really helped me, yes.
Yeah. One of the other things, we're kind of running short on time here. I knew this was going to be an interview just chock full of value, but I keep thinking of other questions as we go along. So added a little bit to it, but it's been great. You do quite a bit of medical writing. You're an editor for The Hospitalist, which is the publication for the Society of Hospital Medicine. Tell me a little bit about your medical writing and how you got involved in that.
So Society of Hospital Medicine, I'm a member of the SHM, Society of Hospital Medicine, for many years. And then they ask for any members to be on the editorial board. You have 2 years of the term of becoming editorial board member. So I got selected for that before a few years. And since then, I'm writing almost every other month in this Hospitalist publication. But my interest in medical writing actually grew organically from my clinical work. So as a hospitalist, you see patterns every day, recurring problems in workflow, communication gaps, medication errors, and system issues that affect the patient care. So early in my career, I would notice that these issues and they discuss them with the colleagues. But over time, I realized that many of these insights could be kind of beyond just our own hospital. And then writing became a way for me to step back from the daily clinical pace and reflect on what we were learning on the front lines of the medicine. So it allowed me to translate the real clinical experiences into the ideas that other physicians and healthcare leaders could think about or potentially apply in their own system. So when I later pursued my physician executive MBA, that perspective expanded even more. And then I began looking into at healthcare, not only through the lens of individual patient care, but also through the system design and operation and strategy. So medical writing became a natural extension of that, which is kind of connecting frontline clinical insights with the broader conversation about how healthcare evolved.
Do you have a role model for your medical writing? Someone that you really look to pattern your writing after or get ideas from?
So I would be honest about that. The role model is my father himself. He's not a medical physician or anybody like that, but he writes very well. He's a social person who runs the NGOs back in rural India, and he's driven by the Gandhian ideology. So I have seen him writing so many stuff, non-medical stuff. So he was my ideal to kind of give me some sort of courage to write something in my field, which is medical field. But when I started writing before a few years, I was not sure that I was confident about writing stuff. But after doing my PEMBA, I have seen people talking about it, writing about it. And some of my colleagues from the PEMBA, I have seen the LinkedIn post and how they write, how they express their thoughts. And that actually gave me the courage to kind of be more expressional. So I would say my father was the first one, but then my PEMBA community really helped me to achieve this.
Now, do you have your father read what you write before you publish it? Does he redline it for you? Or
Yes. Initially, yes. When I was writing in my initial years, I used to send him a draft back in India. And he used to call me back and tell me what I should and what I should not and how should I proceed, but no more, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Now, what's your future in medical writing? Are you going to continue to, after your editorial stint for The Hospitalist ends, are you going to continue to publish? Have you thought about starting a blog or writing a book, those kinds of things, or are you... Tell me a little bit about what you're thinking about.
Of course, now with the social media, if you want to write, you can write anywhere, including the LinkedIn post. So it depends what my mood looks like, what my career looks like, and how much bandwidth I will have. But I would definitely like to express my thoughts or what I see in the healthcare world and how we can change it, how I can express my thoughts, my writing in of those thoughts. And that's where the goal is. So I have not thought any particular arena where I would be jumping into after I finish my term with the hospitalist, but I would keep writing somewhere.
Okay. Thank you. I wonder if you could share with us maybe one story of head-to-head result of a patient or physician who was suffering from burnout that had a real significant change because of their involvement with a hospital at home program.
Yeah. And that story myself, I would say. I was facing a burnout as a hospitalist for this many years and just working 7 on 7 off, seeing 15 to 20 patients a day in the hospital, rounding on them and discharging them like a machine, and then seeing some of them patients back as a readmission after a few days was really kind of breaking my heart, because I was thinking that I'm trying to do this much thing in the hospital, but then I don't have any leverage or I don't have any control after they leave the hospital. And that's where this model of hospital home helped me to understand what is going on at home and how I can prevent the readmission. So it also gives me satisfaction. It also gives me flexibility of working from home. And at the same time, it also gives me some thought that how we can improve the overall delivery of the care. And that gives me kind of perspective, new perspective, using my PEMBA knowledge and everything else, that the care is not about just, as a physician, the care is not just about providing an outpatient or inpatient setting and seeing the patient for your 15 or 30 minutes encounter and then go to the next patient. It is more about kind of continuity of the care and making sure the patients are not falling into those cracks or not into the silos where these silos are not connected. So it is giving me more satisfaction being a hospitalist in this model than I used to be just as a traditional hospitalist.
Has it helped you be a better physician, do you think?
I think so. I would say how you define the better physician means, are you more compassionate? Are you more knowledgeable? Or do you have more time to talk to the patient, right? Because nowadays, we don't have a time to talk to the patient. We are just jumping around. And from that standpoint, I would say, yes, it has given me more time to talk to my patients. Also, it has helped to make myself calm, because I'm one-to-one with the patient on the camera without any distraction around. When I'm in the hospital, either pager is beeping, overhead speaker is talking, or the nurse is coming and going. Here, I am one-to-one with the patient. I have 30, 40 minutes per encounter. And I am talking with the patient. Patient is talking with me. We are talking so many things, outside medical things as well. And that helps, really helps to understand what is going on in the patient's life, patient's social circumstances. But it also helps me to kind of one step backwards and think about it, that how I could have done this differently, how I could help this patient versus my next patient, because these are two different situations. So yes, it has given me more peace as a hospitalist, because peace is very important being a physician. If you don't have a peace, I think you're not going to last long.
Yes, I agree. Well, I'm glad you shared that story with us. Thank you very much.
Of course.
Before we close, I just wonder if there's anything else that you really wanted to touch on or share with the audience that we really just haven't had the opportunity to discuss.
Yeah, so I would like to share this thing, that we are always in the rush of our career, going through the medical school, residency, being a hospitalist or any other medical professional, and then pursuing the second degree, third degree. I have 2 degrees, MPH, MBA, etc. But I think we need to look backwards, or we need to look one step behind us, that this is really what we want, or is there anything else which is lacking in our life? And what I would say, I have been in the hospital or healthcare world for 20 years. Most important thing is not about your knowledge. Most important thing is not about how much you can achieve or how much you can earn. But most important thing is what gives you pleasure. What gives you pleasure, not yourself, but to your family, to your patients, and whatever it will be, that's the answer here. So as a physician, the burnout is a very big thing. I have seen myself to my colleagues. And a part of the problem is the system design. Part of the problem is the healthcare environment we work in, the healthcare economics we work in. But with this PEMBA knowledge, you don't have to be dependent on the systems. You don't have to be dependent on the circumstances around you. You can be the one who can create your own path. And that path doesn't have to be a CEO, CFO, or president of any health system. It can be anything. You can be a person who will be happy as a physician just based on what you have learned through the PEMBA. And that's what I like about PEMBA. It is not just about the healthcare economics or the leadership. It is about the overall comprehensive how to take care of yourself, how to take care of your family and patients. So one short message I would like to say is stay focused, but stay healthy and stay happy.
Thank you, Mihir. Well, it's been great having you on the show today. I so much appreciate you taking time out of your day to be on the podcast and to share your knowledge and the work that you're doing with the PEMBA alumni who will be listening to this, who are listening to this. So thank you very much.
You're welcome. It was a great pleasure.
I would like to thank Dr. Patel for joining us on PEMBA On Demand and for sharing his insights on physician leadership, operational excellence, and the evolving future of hospital at home. His journey from clinical training to executive leadership and innovation offers a valuable example of what is possible when physicians desire to have a broader impact. Thanks to all of you for joining and listening. PEMBA On Demand podcasts are released bi-monthly on Thursdays. Please join us in 2 weeks on March 24th, 2026. Our guest will be Dr. Rob Hedrick, PEMBA 2014. Dr. Hedrick is a thoracic surgeon specializing in lung cancer. He is an author, speaker, and inventor. We will be discussing his passion to improve early diagnosis and treatment of lung cancer through innovation and patient access to early detection tools. Be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/@PEMBAOnDemand. That's PEMBAON-DEMAND, no spaces. Share this episode with a colleague and join us next time for more conversations with leaders from the physician executive MBA community. Also, don't forget to check out our show notes for today's show. I will be including links to Dr. Patel's LinkedIn page, as well as to some articles and LinkedIn posts that he has written. We'll also include information about where you can obtain more information about hospital at home programs. Thanks for listening to PEMBA On Demand. We release new episodes bi-weekly, every other Thursday. You'll find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Castos. Hit follow or subscribe to us and add us to your library. If today helped you, please leave a quick review and share the show with a colleague. Questions or comments? Drop them on our YouTube channel, PEMBA On Demand. For episode links and resources, check the show notes and visit tiny.utk.edu/PEMBAOnDemand, all one word. Take good care and keep becoming a bigger force for good in healthcare.